How's everyone doing? This is Nick Deolius. You're listening to the Far Middle Podcast, episode 47. I hope everybody is enjoying their mid-April and getting spring weather that's being cooperative. I'm sure not all of us are, but I hope that you are. With our dedication for episode 47, it's not going to be a shock for the constant listeners to know a little bit about sort of my sports leanings and my background. I'm going to go with Mel Blount, perhaps in what I believe to be the greatest cornerback in the history of the National Football League, completely redefined the position, redefined a lot of the rules with respect to defense and trying to create better balance between the offense and defense because he dominated so much. And that steel curtain defense, which he was one of the linchpins of, dominated so much through the 70s, four-time Super Bowl champ, of course. But yeah, I do consider Blount clearly for a lot of different reasons. His overall approach to the game, his physical gifts, the team that he played on, specifically that defense that he played on. I believe he was the greatest cornerback in the history of football. And he really did define the standard, a new standard for bump and run coverage. He changed the rules on contact between receivers and defensive backs because he was so dominant. So we talked about how that's always a sign of greatness when it comes to the sports arena, that you disrupted things, you innovated things to such a great extent that the rules were actually changed. I think with a Bob Gibson dedication a few episodes back, two episodes ago on 45, we talked about that, on how he lowered the mound because he was so dominant when it came to the rules of baseball. Mel Blount, same story. So he was truly a great Georgia native, went to Southern University for college, which is in, I believe, Baton Rouge down in Louisiana. And 1972 was his breakout year in the pros. A lot of Steeler fans and football fans in general don't realize that early in his career as a pro, Mel Blount was also a kick returner. So he was sort of multifaceted early in his career before he dedicated himself completely to playing defense. And I'll tell you another sign of greatness when it comes to athletes, business people, different leaders out there. What are they doing sort of post-career? What are they doing beyond their particular craft to make a difference in a good way? And Mel Blount certainly fits the bill with respect to that, because the off-the-field work that he got involved with, and basically he built himself with the Mel Blount Youth Home, is pretty amazing. The Mel Blount Youth Home, by the way, is about a half-hour drive to the south from where I'm sitting right now in southern Pittsburgh in the suburbs. You go a little further south for about a half an hour, you'll come to the Mel Blount Youth Home. He originally built that to basically provide refuge, I guess, for kids, youth that were in need of emergency services, that type of thing, because of difficult circumstances and wrong paths in life, et cetera, with respect to either their families and their surroundings or themselves. And now, from what I understand, Mel Blount has really grown this into more of also a leadership academy, where he has gone from, you know, basically being able to handle maybe a couple dozen individual kids that were needing help on a very intensive basis, to now expanding this with the leadership academy that he's built, where he's literally dealing with thousands of kids at any given point in time. Pretty amazing effort. True gentleman, awesome football player, great human being. Episode 47 goes to the great Mel Blount. So let's go with Mel Blount, start connecting dots. A fellow Far Middle listener asked me about the next topic, which sort of reminds me of how Mel Blount, with just a stare — he's so intimidating with that stare — can bring order to a room real quick. I'm sure that's the case. And most of you know that I prefer, from a policy perspective, minimal government intervention. Call it being a libertarian, call it what you like, but I prefer minimal government versus maximum government, which of course is far from what we have today across society and the economy. But the one clear duty of the federal government under the Constitution, and when you also add on top of it Supreme Court precedents, is the responsibility to regulate interstate commerce, interstate commerce clause, etc. And a listener recently asked me about why the feds, the federal government for once, doesn't seem interested in doing their job when it comes to the interstate commerce responsibility and the interstate commerce clause. And what it dealt with were the rampant thefts that are occurring in Los Angeles at the rail yards with these rail cars and the goods or packages that they're carrying. Now, this is a great question that came from one of the listeners, proving once again that the Far Middle has smart, highly intelligent listeners. I think we all knew that. This is just another positive proof point of that. And these rail yards, I'm sure you've seen the photos by now on the internet of them or in the news. They're close to those major ports in Los Angeles. So you got all these goods and packages coming off the massive ocean-going ships that are coming into port. They're then being transferred from the ships and the port into the rail cars at the rail yards. And then there's thieves that are basically stripping some of these cars bare and leaving a lot of the packages along the tracks, which are creating those optics and those photos that I spoke about. So when the thieves are descending on the tracks and stripping the rail cars of all these packages and goods, they're making a mess of it while they do it. That creates the photo op that you see. And it becomes quite the eyesore for Los Angeles and frankly for all of California. Now, in some ways, and effectively, California and Los Angeles, with some leaders like the Los Angeles District Attorney, they brought this on themselves because they won't prosecute or even arrest anyone that is stealing less than $950 in goods. So it's basically a misdemeanor if it's under $950. And that means it's not going to be pursued seriously by police or law enforcement, let alone be prosecuted. Now, what looks like a California problem, it's actually becoming a national and thus a federal government problem. And this is really where the listener who raised the question, really what they were speaking to and what got me thinking. So thanks again to that listener. It goes back to interstate commerce. These trains and their cargoes, that's what they're carrying. They're carrying interstate commerce. They're carrying goods that are meant for end users or consumers or buyers all across the nation. And this is a nation right now, of course, that's suffering scarcity across a whole spectrum of goods and services because of policy strangling our supply chain. And it's also a nation that's suffering inflation because of criminal acts like what's going on with these rail yards in California that are jacking up the cost of doing business, and that gets passed on to consumers. So clearly, this is interfering with interstate commerce at a really bad time when we're dealing with supply chain inflation and everything else. So how about the Biden administration and the federal government that it's leading getting on the problem post-haste? Maybe what we should do is deputize Mel Blunt, and he will straighten this all out right quick. By the way, that would be an awesome idea or script for an action movie, deputizing Mel Blunt, making him a marshal or something like that, and having him straighten things out where they need straightened out. Maybe I'll save that idea for a future Hollywood script, see if anybody would be interested in taking me up on that. Now, as the feds, you know, with the federal government, California, Los Angeles, as all these different regions and entities go soft on basic theft and basic crime, and we all end up suffering the consequences, here's another thought to connect, another example of how we are getting soft at the worst possible time. So let's talk about the timing first. You look around the world, you look at the map of the world, what do you see? You see Russia on the prowl, that's obvious. China warming up its operations in Asia. Who knows what's coming next there, but I have a strong feeling it's not going to be good news. Iran is out there constantly looking for a fight. North Korea, they're doing anything they can to get attention, including starting a shooting war. And that shooting war could not be with guns. It might be with ballistic missiles. So we've never been more in need of our armed forces than in the past 30 years than we are today. It's probably been the most dangerous that the globe has been in decades, I'd say 30 years. So you've got the Navy SEALs. And the Navy SEALs, they have one of the best mottos ever. Their motto is, "The only easy day was yesterday." And how true is that? But they're, of course, a key component of our armed forces. But now the Navy SEALs have a new problem to contend with. You see, they've trained for 30 years at beaches in Washington State, but in Washington State parks. So where there's state parks in Washington and they're up along beaches, the Navy SEALs have trained there with the water land training that they do. Now you've got an environmental group along with a law firm that is seeking to bar the SEALs from training at any state park beaches because doing so is going to cause trauma. It's going to cause environmental and psychological trauma. I think that's what they pointed out, to see, you know, armed men and women running about and doing their training if they're SEALs. Now, by the way, this training that I'm talking about, it's not live fire. It's not like they're running around shooting guns or firing off munitions. And this is the state, ladies and gentlemen, of our nation in 2022. You've got environmental groups and attorneys that are filing suits to stop Navy SEALs from training to better protect us from growing risks that have never been coming from more dangerous adversaries. So you got all-time, you know, dangerous adversaries. You've got all-time highest risks. You couple them together, and this is what we're dealing with: environmental groups and attorneys stopping the Navy SEALs from training and being prepared. As I said before, Putin and the Chinese Communist Party, their best friends, more often than not, are environmental groups. Now, perhaps Putin's second best friend is the Vatican, specifically here, Pope Francis. Many of you know I've been a bit of a critic of the current Pope in Rome, mostly because of his mission creep that's pushing Catholicism and things like papal infallibility, really important aspect of Catholicism, into arenas that the Pope knows nothing about. And the best example, of course, the biggest example, is what he's doing with climate change and climate change policies. And while Pope Francis is lecturing on topics that he knows little to nothing about, he's doing things in arenas that he should be leading on that makes you scratch your head. And frankly, it makes me worry and fret as a Catholic. What I'm talking about here is how he continues to refuse to call out Russia as the aggressor with the whole situation surrounding Ukraine, which is really hard to believe. I just can't square that, why he refuses to do that. And maybe he doesn't want to appear to agree with the United States policy, which could betray his bias. That doesn't make much sense. It's frankly nonsensical relative to what the United States stands for and how we've become a beacon, not just for Catholics, but for religious freedoms all over the world. So it doesn't make much sense, but there you have it. The Pope also says that there is no such thing as a just war, which means he's not going to support Ukraine's right to defend itself. And he also criticized nations in Europe that are part of NATO as they increase investment on defense to over 2% of GDP. How does he do that? He says that the true response is not more weapons or sanctions, but in the real world, this is the true response to deter or to respond to more killing and war. That's how you stop these things or prevent these things. I feel like the Pope is about to break into song with his rendition of the Beatles' All We Need Is Love. Instead, I think it's time for Pope Francis and the Vatican to get real with what's going on in the world. Now, why would we have these pretty nonsensical, ridiculous stances by the Pope? It could be good old-fashioned self-interest and consistency with a legacy of neutrality when it comes to the church at the worst possible times. So just think about it. Now, the Vatican wants to first heal the schism with the Russian Orthodox faith. Pope Francis has been working on that for some time. To use sort of business speak or corporate speak, it would be a good merger. The strategic, right? It has good business sense tied to it in the religious world. And of course, the Russian Orthodox faith is supportive of Putin. So that might be a reason why the Vatican has been quite apologetic when it comes to Vladimir Putin. The Vatican has also been neutral since the 1800s when it comes to conflict, wars, global, regional, whatever the case might be. That's not good for a religion that should be leading, at least from my opinion, on morality during times of war and on right and wrong. That's what they're supposed to be leading on. That's why it never moved. The church in the Vatican, the Catholic Church, never moved against Mussolini, never really moved against the Nazis during World War II. That's not a good look for neutrality or the Vatican. Makes me personally sad, bordering on ashamed. And then there's just, of course, the idea or the potential that this is all just about personal vainglory and the desires of the Pope. He may like Putin. He held court with him at the Vatican not once, not twice, but three times. Maybe now I'm sounding like Lionel Richie, once, twice, three times a lady. And the Pope didn't criticize Russia when they invaded the Crimea in 2014, didn't criticize Russia when they got involved in Syria in 2015. But we do know that the Pope is capable of heavy criticism or shunning world leaders, because he did that with the leader of our nation not long ago, for those of you that remember who that was and when that happened. Now, how's all this adding up for Catholics when you look at the culmination of the Pope's behavior and the Vatican's leadership, or lack thereof, when it comes to what's going on in Eastern Europe. Is the Pope a socialist first and a Catholic second? Is he more Che and Fidel than Pope John Paul II? Times like these really test those types of questions to provide insight. And unfortunately, what I'm seeing as insight is very troubling from the perspective of a Catholic. Now, the reason we're talking about all this when it comes to religion and Catholicism is that religions, much like governments, they're organisms, and specifically they're organisms that favor the groupthink. I don't know if you're familiar or not with William White, the author. He had a great book that he published called The Organization Man. I've been able to read different pieces of it through the years. It's on my list to get through from start to finish. But what White did an awesome job doing was pointing out the dangers of groupthink and status quo. He talked about how rational conformity defines what's good and right, and how what that rational conformity is defining as good and right and reality can often be both wrong and dangerous, the exact opposites of what it's warranting. Now, the Pope and the Vatican and current administrations in Washington, D.C. or in Europe, and elite academia, these organizations believe that the global institution is always going to be right or better or superior. They believe that appeasement of evil is the best path, is the most acceptable path. They believe the climate change is a bigger threat to humanity than strongmen in places like Russia and China. And they're wrong. But when you dissent or you speak up, it's going to be shouted out or it's going to be vilified, whether it's just through something like rational conformity or whether it's just through the culture that we're operating and living within today. And that is going to manifest in really big and very nasty consequences, as we're learning, when it comes to Ukraine and the South China Sea and inflation and in kids' educational acumen or lack thereof in our big cities and energy insecurity. And while all this is going on, what's happening with those institutions and those governments that are practicing the groupthink and the status quo and rational conformity? Well, they're growing, they're getting bigger, they're spending more. All of this is going to just exacerbate the problems. Now, speaking of growth of the state, that takes us to our next dot to connect. Governments have, in the end, three ways that they can fund their activities or what they do. So governments can tax, governments can borrow, or governments can print money. Now, we've discussed in prior episodes of The Far Middle and in my book Precipice, two of these three methods at length. We talked about the borrowing component or the printing money avenue. So on borrowing, many of you that have been listening know about the $30+ trillion in debt that our government holds and how it's growing and how that's 125% of GDP. Goodness gracious. When it comes to printing money, we've talked about that at length. Call it modern monetary theory, whatever you'd like, but what the Federal Reserve is doing with respect to quantitative easing and then the delayed quantitative tightening, what it's doing with interest rates and how on a real basis they're negative and have been negative for some time. Milton Friedman, if he were alive today to watch all this, he would be freaking out. But there's that third way, which is tax and taxing. And ladies and gentlemen, our federal government is awash in cash from tax revenues. For the first 5 months of 2022 versus the same time in 2021, the first 5 months of 2021, total receipts are up 26%. Personal income taxes are up 38%, and corporate income taxes are up 31% for the first 5 months of this year versus the same time last year. So should Congress be investigating value creators and businesses for what you're hearing and reading about windfall profits and excessive greed? Or instead, should we the citizens, we the taxpayers, should we be investigating Congress and our own government for windfall profits and excessive greed? The data would tell you we should be considering the latter, not the former. And before we leave the topic of how government has three ways to fund itself, let's just spend a minute talking about one of those ways in a little more detail, which is the printing of money. We just said the Fed's been doing that at unprecedented rates now for 12 years, over a decade plus. Pretty unbelievable. But while it's been doing that, it's also been very busy at trying to expand its mission to cover things from social justice to climate change, things way beyond monetary policy. I just wrote a commentary on that, by the way, that you might enjoy if you give it a read on nickdeolias.com under the commentary section about how we need to stop the Fed's mission creep. Give that a look if you get a chance. But now everybody likes to tout how the Federal Reserve is apolitical and non-political and independent politically, whatever term you want to use. But the facts are starting to indicate something very different, because at a minimum, some of the data coming back and some of the research is indicating that the Fed is clearly partisan, to the point where I fear it might be becoming monopartisan. There's a researcher out there by the name of Emre Kuvay, who recently published research that shows some pretty significant, pretty extreme partisanship of Fed economists. The overall ratio of Fed economists, Democrat to Republican, was over 10 to 1. 10 Democrats for every Republican economist. When you look at the Board of Governors and the economists that work there, it's a 48 to 1 ratio, 48 Democrat economists on the Board of Governors to every one Republican. And the regional banks, same sort of weighting that favored Democrats versus Republicans. There was a lot of variation across the different regional banks. For example, I saw Cleveland, its regional bank was a 3-to-1 ratio, Democrats to Republican with economists, where the San Francisco Fed, it was a 12-to-1 ratio of Democrats over Republicans. And initially when I saw this, those ratios are pretty stark, pretty severe. Personally, I'm not as worried about Democrats versus Republicans. To me, that's not the big issue, right? We're all Americans when it comes to our history and our legacy across those two parties. I don't stay up at night worrying about a Democrat doing this versus a Republican economist doing that. But what I do fear, what I am concerned about, is the left thing. In other words, with a lot of leftist ideology and frankly, a lot of leftists sort of embedding themselves within the Democratic Party, especially the extreme wing of the Democratic Party, those ratios that we're seeing with economists at the Federal Reserve, is that not just a Democrat-Republican thing, but is that also a leftist to non-leftist type of a ratio or type of a thing? If it is, if leftist ideology correlates to those Democrat ratios that you just saw, that explains a lot about the Fed policies and moves lately, and that does give me a lot of concern. That does keep me up at night. This dynamic of a government institution or a piece of the bureaucracy, like the Federal Reserve, becoming political and answerable to special interests or ideologies, that is the Iron Triangle in action. And the Iron Triangle was detailed and is detailed in my book, Precipice. There's three corners of the triangle, of course, and one is the special interest or the lobbyist that's providing dollars and support. In the other corner, the second corner of the triangle, is a bureaucrat or a lawmaker who's setting the rules and setting the regulations and setting the policies that favor the special interest or the lobbyist who contributed to the politician's or the bureaucrat's campaign or budget. And then in the third and final corner of the triangle is the judge or the court who's going to weigh in to give the bureaucrat's law or the politician's regulation or policy the legal heft and the legitimacy to support the other two corners, and who has also received support from one or both of those other corners when the individual got nominated or elected to their seat on the bench. The Iron Triangle is alive and well, not just at the Federal Reserve, but also in places supposedly non-political because they're following the science. Whenever you say following the science, you almost have to put them in the air quotes these days. And an entity that sort of fits that bill is the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control. Yes, I'm sure they're following the science. Now, the House has a committee on coronavirus, and that committee just released a report that showed officials at the CDC testified that the center coordinated with public teachers unions on the rules for school reopenings and the guidance tied to school reopenings. The two largest public teachers unions in the land received the guidance that the CDC was drafting and was going to issue before the public did. In other words, they received this before the parents did or before you heard about it. And one of the unions demanded that the CDC revise the guidance. And guess what the CDC did? It revised the guidance. And then the guidelines were released to the citizenry. That's when you found out about it and when parents found out about it and taxpayers and kids. Worse yet, the official who testified on this activity was instructed by the Biden administration lawyers to not answer certain questions that the House committee members were asking. I wonder why they instructed that official to do so. What is there to hide? Could there possibly be anything to hide? So this is the Iron Triangle at its worst. This is public teachers union throwing huge dollars at politicians into the support of the bureaucracy like the CDC. The CDC shares guidelines with the union before issuing and allows them to effectively co-author the guidelines. Those guidelines are used to keep kids out of schools and helps impede their learning. And then lawyers in the administration and in the third corner of that iron triangle, they serve as the arbiter by not allowing the CDC officials to answer questions. How conflicted, how damaging. It goes to show you the inherent conflict of a public union. They often work against the client that they exist or swear to serve. And that brings us to our next topic, the next dot to connect, which is who pays the price when the iron triangle is in effect? Because all that graft within the triangle has to be paid by someone or something. In the case of public teachers unions and the CDC with school opening guidelines, the entities that paid the price were students, a la kids, parents, and taxpayers. Now, why or how? The World Bank, UNICEF, UNESCO, they all issued a joint report that showed how the least exposed demographic to COVID, which were kids, paid the steepest price for pandemic policies through school and societal shutdowns. This was a global study, not just to the US, and here is an unbelievable statistic. Over 1.5 billion kids were shut out of schools globally during pandemic, and when the heavy hand of government took hold. Remote learning is a bit of a joke. I think we all know that now. School closure caused more harm than good. And in the United States, the learning damage was the greatest for minority students and those from the poorest and the underserved communities. Yet the iron triangle of the public teachers union, the bureaucracy like the CDC and the politicians, it just keeps chugging along. You saw Chicago teachers union in early 2022 when they halted in-person learning. You saw this with Minneapolis teachers who struck in March, sending kids home once again this year for more pay. And then you saw Dr. Fauci. I guess you can consider this a Fauci-focused moment when we thought we were done with Dr. Fauci, where he's warning that we could shut things down again if a stealth Omicron appears. Now, as we leave the topic of how public unions trampled students underfoot, it's time to wrap episode 47 of The Far Middle. Hope you enjoyed it. Speaking of trampled underfoot, let's talk about what was at the top of the Billboard album charts way back in 1975 for the entire month of April, I believe. And I think it is the best double album ever and the best album from a legendary act. I'm talking about Physical Graffiti from Led Zeppelin. Yeah, I think it was the band's best work. It was their hardest, crunchiest album of the whole catalog. By the way, Robert Plant and Jimmy Page agree with me that it was their best work. I think they would know better than I would. You've got, you know, awesome songs on side one with Custard Pie and The Rover. Side two has Houses of the Holy, which interestingly isn't on Houses of the Holy album by Led Zeppelin. It's on Physical Graffiti. Trampled Underfoot and Cashmere. So Houses of the Holy, Trampled Underfoot, Cashmere. That is an album side for the ages. Side three, In the Light, 10 Years Gone. Love those songs. Side four had Sick Again, which is a very underrated Led Zeppelin song. This album was so good that when it was issued, it dragged every prior Led Zeppelin album onto the top 200 charts. So all their other prior albums got drug into the charts because people started buying the other albums when they heard Physical Graffiti. And it was the first album ever to go platinum based off of advanced orders alone. I think it's got one of the best album covers ever in terms of its design. You know, it slides when you slide out the album sleeve, the letters that spell out Physical Graffiti and the windows of the tenement building. That was taken a photo of from Lower Manhattan in New York City that slides out with it. And here's an interesting factoid. Rolling Stone, you know, some of you, that that's not my favorite music magazine. It ranks the 500 greatest albums of all time. Now, in 2003, when it published its 500 greatest album list, Physical Graffiti was number 70 on the list. It's a really strong showing. In 2020, Rolling Stone reissued their top 500 albums of all time. And Physical Graffiti went from number 70 down to number 144. Now, why did Physical Graffiti's ranking plummet? Were there 70 epic albums released between 2003 and 2020 that supplanted it? I don't think so. Maybe shake up orders and rankings to create controversy so people read and buy the list in the magazine. Wouldn't that be capitalistic? And wouldn't that be a money motive from supposedly a leftist periodical? That doesn't seem consistent. Or did the band and the genre go from artistically fashionable to unfashionable or non-politically correct? You never know these days with Rolling Stone. The last thing that seems to matter is the music, unfortunately. Till next week, rock on.